Murray novelist. That does it for our show. I'll be in Edinburgh, Scotland, the King's Theatre on August 11th and on August 12th, throwing a Steal the Story, Please at the Bertha Dock House in London. Right now, we're here in New York. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. Thursday at this time, it's the Northern Sun Radio News with Don Olson and Dave Koenig. And today we have some special guests in the studio. We're going to talk about Cuba. Greg Clave of the Minnesota Cuba Committee and Rebecca Pera of SCOTA, which stands for?
The Solidarity Committee on the Americas.
Good. Well, it could be not more apropos. I've been reading about it. There's a new issue of Dollars and Cents, the costs of the blockade of Cuba, assessment of the 64-year-old blockade, now that the country is under Trump's policy of, quote, maximum pressure. So this is one I distribute to the co-ops and some bookstores.
Don, maybe we should keep going with Cuba for the first half. I had kind of planned the other way around, but if it's okay, we could just jump right in.
Good.
Really, really glad to have you folks here. And I just want to repeat that Dollars and Cents is a longstanding, very reputable, lefty economic analysis kind of publication. They cover mostly domestic issues, but this one is good on Cuba.
So today on Democracy Now! We heard that there a special task force on Cuba has been set up, and that it's all part of, well, why don't you two, Greg and Rebecca, talk about what you see that which is going on there. What's this maximum pressure and all that? Because I thought it was pretty intense before, but now it seems to be getting more and more. But is it that way at all?
Yeah, I think that it's important to note that ever since January, when Trump and Rubio put a new oil blockade against the island, Cuba, and since then only one oil tanker has been able to arrive in Cuba, which was from Russia at approximately middle towards the end of April. That has really been when this maximum pressure campaign has started escalating. And since then, we've seen a variety of additional sanctions placed against the Cuban people and the island that have resulted in 20 to 22 hour per day blackouts where you know, the infant mortality rate has substantially increased in Cuba, despite the fact that Cuba, since 1959, has had one of the lowest infant mortality rates in the entire hemisphere due to their exceptional medical school and medical brigades. And we've also seen July 20th, the U.S. State Department issued a 100-page report that targeted multiple organizations, including our own, both the Minnesota Cuba Committee and SCOTA, because we are members of what is called the National Network on Cuba, NNOC. We're a coalition of approximately 140 Cuba solidarity groups around the country. And that 100-page report essentially attempted to blame Cuba for all of the progressive movements in the last several decades in the United States, including the civil rights movement, uprisings after George Floyd was murdered, Black Lives Matter, all of the ICE occupation protests and mutual aid that we have done in not only in Minneapolis and St. Paul, but also throughout the country. All of these things the U.S. State Department really tried to pin onto Cuba. And a lot of folks are saying it's an attempt at twofold purpose. Number one, in order to justify potentially a military attack against Cuba in the coming days or weeks. And number two, to silence any solidarity efforts within the United States for Cuba and the Cuban people.
Yeah, good afternoon, listeners of Northern Sun News. We're happy to be with you today. This is a new McCarthyism that's invading our political environment. This report identified National Lawyers Guild, Code Pink, Black Panthers, the Free Palestine Movement, et cetera, et cetera.
An honorable list.
Yes.
Pastors for Peace.
Pastors for Peace. And not only did it identify them as being part of the propaganda campaign of Cuba, but just recently, one of the architects of this, Steve Miller, Homeland Security Advisor in the Trump administration, has called our groups a threat to civilization and terrorists. What a twisted mind.
Pure projection.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what have we done? What we have done is tried to save lives. We've tried to solidify the call that all Americans are making right now, the call for universal health care, like Cuba has, the call for free higher education, like Cuba has, the call for a right for housing, for homes, a right to combat climate change. This is everything that Cuba has. And that's why Cuba has been not only a inspiration for us, because we're fighting for what Americans want, and you can see it in the polls today and in the voting booths that we've seen recently. But what Cuba means to the world, when the world called, Cuba answered, and now it's time for the world to come to Cuba's aid. Cuba fought fearlessly the South African apartheid army and liberated Angola, Namibia, South Africa, ended apartheid. And remember, the first country that Nelson Mandela visited after his release from prison was Cuba, to thank them. It's been an inspiration around the world for their medical teams that they send to help where no other medical teams would go in their own countries because of the poverty, because of the way that medical health care is set up for profit. And we see that terribly in this country, as more and more families face bankruptcy because of crippling medical bills. Mm-hmm. We see them out in the street because that's all they have left. But all this lies and paternalism, it's like, oh, U.S. citizens can't think for themselves, you know. We have to be programmed by Cuba or China or Russia or Iran or whoever. When it's all been a part of the plan of the United States government to overthrow Cuba, to overthrow all these other countries. So they're trying to turn reality on its head. For 67 years, they failed. Now, Trump thinks that because 13 presidents failed before him, he's going to be the one. And as Rebecca has talked about, the drastic sanctioning of all Cuban trade, of blockading the oil, that still hasn't caused Cuba to be a failed state. They are still surviving. Now, why do they go after American citizens, like ICE goes after American citizens or hardworking immigrants who have come to America to make America strong? It's because they have nothing left but violence and lies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think Greg brought up a really good point that even throughout this complete exploitation and repression of Cuba, as well as at home, with 22-hour blackouts every day, ELAM, which is the Latin American School of Medicine in Havana, Cuba, which is the most well-renowned medical school in the entire world, still managed to graduate 1,600 doctors from 71 different countries this year. So if Cuba can manage to do such an amazing feat in the face of such adversity imposed by the U.S. Imperialist government, imagine the types of gains that could be made not only for the Cubans, but also for us here in the United States and in Minnesota, if we could normalize relations with Cuba, if we could end the embargo, if we could remove Cuba off of the SSOT list, the state sponsor of terrorism list, and if we could start to engage in neighborly relations. And another point that I thought was very important that Greg mentioned is that this is considered a new McCarthyism. The July 20th 100-page State Department report is considered a new McCarthyite report. But unlike McCarthyism that we saw, you know, during the 40s and 50s, it does not have public support in the United States. We are seeing that the majority of Americans do not want adversarial and coercive relations with Cuba. And one such example is that very recently, the North Dakota AFL-CIO passed a resolution at their most recent convention to end coercive relations with Cuba, to remove Cuba off the SSOT list, to end the oil blockade, and to end the embargo. And that is an organization that represents approximately 30,000 workers and over 200 local unions. And it's one, and the Washington AFL-CIO State Fed also recently passed a resolution very similar. And we're seeing all of the, in Minneapolis just this past spring, the city council also passed a new resolution to end the oil blockade against Cuba. And if we look at the conglomeration of all of these resolutions and pushback against U.S. foreign policy against Cuba, we see that it represents 60 million workers in the United States, 60 million workers and residents, and over 140 resolutions saying the American public does not support what the U.S. government is doing to Cuba.
The one of the biggest things is Cuba can't get things in, that there's this blockade, no oil gets in. Well, it's kind of hard to keep everything going in a modernish society. But wait, I found out from this article something. The U.S. government knows that a blockade is an act of war. And international law that was established in 1909 at the London Naval Conference, which the U.S. participated in, and the U.S. Senate voted to endorse and define blockades as an act of war. So what do they, what does the U.S. government do? Calls it an embargo.
Yeah, you're right, John. All these actions are illegal actions. They're criminal actions. And that's why, as a result of this, we're asking Americans and to our listeners out there that if there is any kind of U.S. military escalation on Cuba, that we rally on the same day. If it happens before 3 p.m., we rally at the Federal Building in downtown Minneapolis at 5 p.m. If attacks occur after 3 p.m., we rally the next day at 5 p.m. It's our Minnesota Rapid Response Plan. But we encourage people to join us on our social media pages, and we have bannering and picket signs on the Marshall Lake Street Bridge every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. And we consistently have events that remind the public of the perils that we're in. Rebecca talked about the incredible graduation of 1,600 doctors from those nations. Well, one of those nations was the United States. Mm-hmm. Cuba has been training United States citizens free of charge, low-income people that can't afford a doctor degree and license in the United States because it costs so much. They have been able to give them the education to come back then and be doctors in low-income urban areas that have a lack of health care, or rural areas such as Native American reservations where they have a lack of health care. So, yes, Cuba is having an effect on the United States. It's a good effect. And the United States is having a negative effect on Cuba, a criminal effect. One of the reasons why the administration has been attacking our Cuba Solidarity organizations and our Peace and Justice organization is because we've been able to raise money and material supplies to help bring medical supplies and solar equipment to Cuba to help them battle this oil blockade and to help them make that transition to solar energy. And Cuba is doing incredible work on engineering new ways of providing transportation through solar energy. Visit our Facebook pages, Instagrams, to see the kind of work that Cubans are doing to help with that transportation. And because of our work to help Cuba beat back this oil blockade, that makes us a target. But not only people working in the peace and justice and solidarity organizations, but also news outlets such as Breakthrough News, which is a news service that reports on what Americans want to hear that they're not hearing in the mainstream corporate media, such as the genocide in Gaza, the wars in the Middle East, in NATO Russia, ICE detention and their ICE detention centers, climate catastrophes, Cuba, and the AI invasion of our economy, something corporate news does not touch. And they're saying that these views that Cuba, American citizens want to hear about are part of a foreign plot. How could that be? These groups and news services now are having documents subpoenaed by the U.S. administration and are being called before the House Lies and Meanies Committee for grilling that they will try to use to smear popular views of U.S. citizens. So all this is being scrutinized and under attack. And of course, every accusation is a confession, mm-hmm. because right now they are the ones that are being influenced by a foreign government by the name of Israel. Israel has had more of an impact on our government. In fact, we could almost say that they have control of our government and of our electoral system if Americans don't rise up and beat this back. And those concerns are not only affecting us, but they're growing throughout Latin America, Africa, and Europe.
Yep, and I'm really glad that Greg mentioned the Minnesota Rapid Response Plan, and he spoke about the events and activities that our groups, both of which we are both affiliated with the NNOC, the National Network on Cuba. And just to give a plug to an upcoming event that we will be hosting on August 26th at the Main Theater, we will be showing the film Cuba After Castro. And it was put together by journalist Abby Martin, who will also be joining us via Zoom for a question and answer panel. And the money that we raised from that will in part go to Global Health Partners' neonatal campaign to help both mothers and infants in Cuba, who are some of the most vulnerable in society due to the 22-hour blackouts.
Go ahead. If you got more, go ahead.
No, it's okay. Oh. So I might say, over the years, this program has often taken things from breakthrough news. And proudly we say that we have put it on the air from their YouTube channel. Dave, did you have something?
Yeah, I just wanted to return to a couple points that our guest here made. Remember, this kind of embargo and cruel sanctions been imposed since 1960, probably the longest such aggressive campaign, why don't we call it state terrorism, against the Cuban people of any country in the world. And although originally, there was the outcry about the organized crime lost their playground of gambling, drugs, and prostitution, but if you know anything about contemporary history, you know that organized crime has been a close ally of our deep state and our war-making machine since a long time ago, prior to World War II, but especially during World War II. And again, that's not the heart of the problem. The heart of the problem is that Cuba provides an example of what can be done to serve the people, help the people, and serve internationally, helping the people as well. So it's a bad example to the people that run this country, and they want to destroy that example. And now they're escalating that, as I see it, with this latest campaign to manifest this very thing. They want to suppress progressive activities in the United States and suppress the Cuban example. I want to say something further about sanctions, too, because it's really kind of something that outrages me, and I care deeply about it. And people don't realize, as has been mentioned, not only is it illegal, but it's cruel. They're denying food, fuel, medicine, and other essential items. And you know, sanctions are not legal unless they're approved by the United Nations, and none of these has been approved. And I want to remind people also that, of course, we have a whole history of dollar diplomacy for a long time, but it's gotten worse since the dollar became the reserve currency, enabling us to punish people through the IMF and the World Bank and the SWIFT system. And this is why this is now being recognized by more and more of the world, and they're slowly trying to move away from it. But don't forget, I've mentioned before, The Lancet, the prestigious medical journal, in a study of a year and a half ago, or less than 2 years ago, about sanctions, revealed that over a 30-year period, the average death caused by U.S. and European sanctions is over 500,000, mostly women and children, mm-hmm. per year. So this is what's really going on in our name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, just another example of how Cuba provides inspiration and offers beneficial solutions for the citizens of the world. They have a biopharmaceutical industry that's really unmatched by any in the world. They realized this when the United States started blockading medicines to them that they needed to be able to provide their own medicines. During COVID, they developed 3 vaccines that were as effective as any of the other pharmaceutical industry vaccines that were used in the Western world.
But not the mRNA, I believe.
And not the MR1 or whatever that technology that they used. It was a technology that works with the immune system of the body, mm-hmm. but they did one injection, was one of them. Then another was injection without any animal byproducts in it for those religions that didn't want any animal byproducts in their bodies. And the third was administered through the nose.
Mm-hmm.
So
inhalation.
It was for people who didn't want any needles in them. So, and they were all safe for children, for infants 2 years or older. They've also developed vaccines for lung cancer, which is a major problem in this country and could save the lives of many people. They've developed vaccines to stop the decay in the extremities of a diabetes infection, and they also have a vaccine now for leukemia in infants.
Mm-hmm. As well as Alzheimer's.
Yes, and the most famous one lately is a vaccine or a treatment for Alzheimer's that's administered not through injection, and we have doctors in the United States that are wanting to take patients to Cuba to get that treatment. It's a disease that inflicts over 11 million Americans. Mm-hmm. So this is what the United States is doing to the American people. Mm-hmm. This is not only a war on Cuban people, it's a war on the American people and the corporate and strengthening the corporate grip on our society, mm-hmm. and how it is in control of the government, which is the dictionary definition of fascism.
That's correct. And I think Greg's point of the COVID vaccinations being developed in Cuba, one thing that we saw with the COVID vaccinations was Cuba's dedication to international medical solidarity. Their injection vaccinations, Aldara was one of them, in Cuba, did not need the same degree of refrigeration that our COVID vaccinations needed here, and therefore, and the COVID vaccination that Greg spoke about, the one that was a nasal inhalation, both of these were easily able to be shared and exported to countries throughout the world that did not have the refrigeration capacity that we had here. And so millions of people were able to benefit from Cuba's biotech development of COVID vaccinations that the United States was not willing to develop themselves.
I'd like to keep this part to a close because we got the other half of the program. I want to discuss some things about the Mideast and the war in Iran. But it's clear that there's immensely valuable lessons to be learned from Cuba, and we could benefit a lot from better relations. So I want to thank Rachel and Greg for drawing attention to some of that, as well as upcoming events.
And how can people keep up to date?
People can check our Facebook and Instagram accounts. That is SCOTA, the Solidarity Committee on the Americas, and the Minnesota Cuba Committee. We are both local organizations that belong to the National Network on Cuba and the U.S.-Cuba Normalization Coalition.
Yeah, and then come to the film that Donald Trump does not want you to see, Cuba After Castro, August 26th at the Main Cinema on historic Mississippi River, and help support our groups, rally behind us, and let's get some aid to the Cuban mothers and babies to help them survive this attack by U.S. government, Donald Trump, Marco Rubio, Steve Miller, and all their fascist gang.
Yep, democracy is an active verb. You got to make it happen if you want to get there.
That's right.
Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Have a good day, listeners.
Thanks again. The second half I want to cover, of course, the war that's deepening in West Asia, and some of the manifestations and implications of that are again news beyond the mainstream, which is how I like to characterize this program. So I have some people I want to quote, read a few statements, and then we have one clip from one of the commentators that we've had on before. But here's a quick summary of the current situation by Eve Smith at NakedCapitalism.com, whose site I like a lot and draws in a lot of links, and other contributors as well. The problem is that Trump is much more fundamentally trapped, not merely by the scale and ramifications of the strategic error of the war on Iran, the inability to force Iran to give up control of the Strait of Hormuz, and the revelation of U.S. military fragility, but also his personality and the way key posts are now filled by incompetence and toadies, unquote. So adding to that, as I see it, President Trump's cronies support the liar-in-chief, or else they leave the administration. Negotiations you've heard about, including the U.S., are non-existent, yet another U.S. lie to mislead the public and prolong the war. At present, the only real and promising negotiations are between Oman and Iran over the Strait of Hormuz, and they appear to be close to an agreement, but that's not final either. There are no U.S. negotiations. The Iranians have repeatedly denied that there are any negotiations going on with the U.S. So it's a lie, my friends, to manipulate the public opinion and to manipulate the market, which has been going on for quite a while now. Here's something from Reuters, and other media is now covering this too. In fact, this is about U.S. arms depletion. Don and I have actually been hearing from our sources for weeks and weeks on this. And now Secretary Hegseth has attacked CNN for a banner stating this obvious, to me, obvious truth, and threatened Trump just yesterday threatened to jail leakers of this information. Well, if I had it to leak, I'd leak it, but it's already out there. Yet the U.S. arms depletion, especially air defense missiles, is something, again, that we've heard from commentators for quite a few weeks. Quoting from Reuters, the United States has depleted much of its global stockpile of precision long-range missiles during its five-month military campaign against Iran, according to multiple sources familiar with internal U.S. military data cited by Reuters news agency. The report said the Army has used, quote, virtually all, unquote, of two of its principal surface-to-surface precision weapons. Both systems have been central to Washington's strategy of striking targets from long distances while limiting risk to pilots and aircraft. Reuters reported further that the extent of the depletion has not previously been disclosed publicly. The sources declined to reveal, this is a great last sentence, the sources declined to reveal how many missiles remain in the U.S. inventories, unquote. Remember the promises of a quick war? A short-term pain for long-term gain? What absolute BS that was. Now we're facing long-term pain with no clear outcome and probably getting worse. Even if the Strait of Hormuz and Al-Mandab Strait were conflict-free as of tomorrow, we're facing economic disaster. The West Asia and global supply chains are continuing to fracture and to come up short. We've covered some of this before, and I know we're going to be returning it because, believe me, my friends, the world is on the brink of a possibly severe recession, and the fix is not in. The fix to the war and the Strait and the related conflicts is not at hand. Here's Financial Times, prestigious capitalist outlet, very prestigious, on Trump's traps. Quote, since attacking Iran in February, Trump's immediate demands have shrunk from a sprawling list of concessions involving Tehran's nuclear ambitions, ballistic missile production, and support for proxy militias to just one thing, that Iran allow the Strait of Hormuz to return to its pre-war state. In itself, that would mark something akin to strategic humiliation, say critics. Iran exploited its strategic leverage over the Strait only after Trump launched the war. And one more quote from the chief source of the imperial structure, New York Times, revealing a simple truth. Quote, even if Ukraine's partners did heed Mr. Zelensky's call, they could not fully meet the country's needs, that is, missile and armaments needs. Russia produces ballistic missiles faster than the West can make the interceptors designed to stop them. So, one of the themes here, as I see it, the heart of the theme is real hard limits to U.S. military power, which indicates, or connected, of course, to financial power as well. And I believe there's a big segment of the war makers who cannot believe this is happening because they have been, inculcated in a superiority attitude from, many years back. And but the fact is, they're losing, and they don't have a good way out. And so I think it's going to be a shock to a lot of people to realize that, we're not the greatest, the biggest, the most powerful, the most, etc. And some of this, of course, already know this, but this is the coming realization, and I think it's going to be harder and harder to overlook it.
Yeah, I think that what we're seeing is that American exceptionalism, that white superiority is pervading over diplomacy. And we know after the World War II that diplomacy had effects on growing economies. And now that the military-industrial complex, of which Eisenhower warned us about in his closing speech of his second term, has now taken control, and now they're pushing the whole idea that military might makes right, and that is the wrong path to be taking, and why we need to return to diplomacy and respect for the sovereignty of other nations.
Yeah, sometime we'll talk about that famous speech of Ike's, because one of the motivations was he had been betrayed by the Dulles brothers on Cuba. Okay, we'll get that another time. I have one clip to play today. It's from Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson on the Dialogue Works platform. That's hosted by Nima Al-Khashid, who is a young Iranian professor, but he's based in Brazil, on rare occasions he does visit back in Iran. And Colonel Wilkerson was former chief of staff under Secretary of Defense Colin Powell, so has quite a few years of understanding and experience in how these things play out. So I'm going to play about 6 or 7 minutes. Is it on, Don?
Yep.
Oh, sorry.
We are still putting munitions into Ukraine. So we have this very prominent drain into Ukraine and into Israel and into the conflict with Iran. And that drain is bringing all the stocks down significantly across the globe. So as I indicated before, you've got General Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, having to deal with these other combatant commanders who are becoming very vocal about this happening. At the same time, you've got Secretary Hegseth, who apparently, I know he's being told this. I have it on really good authority that he's being told this. But he doesn't seem to want to do anything that violates his sycophancy, if you will, with Donald Trump. So you don't have anything from the Secretary of Defense, War, whatever you want to call him. You don't have anything from him in this argument other than Kane telling him and, I guess, being stymied at that point. I don't know if Kane has used his power to go directly to the president. Were I he and I felt the way I'm hearing he feels, I would do that. I don't know that it would do any good. It might get him fired. Maybe that's the reason he doesn't do it. But someone needs to tell the commander-in-chief several very significant realities. One, Ukraine is going down big time. And the way it goes down and the depth of the defeat is going to be inimical to NATO for some time to come, and probably ultimately to Washington. We are draining munitions in a war in that theater that cannot possibly be won. And the more we drain those munitions, the more the other side is determining that we are the enemy, not Zelensky. Zelensky's just a tool. I'm not so sure they haven't already determined that. If you heard that speech that Putin gave recently and that the Duma sort of, you know, expressed their desire for him to keep going, you understand how solid the front is in Russia, despite the absolute piss poor reporting by the American media, including the New York Times, about the condition of Russia. Russia is in excellent shape right now in all categories of thought, really, about this theater. The problem we have is that this might and has every possibility of expanding. And we could see even this entire front that we've developed from the Arctic to Chabahar suddenly merge into a really serious regional conflict. And probably ultimately a global conflict. And all of this is because Donald Trump doesn't know what to do about either theater that's prominent, Ukraine or Southwest Asia. He's losing badly in Southwest Asia. He's lying about diplomacy. He lies every day about diplomacy. There is no diplomacy going on, zero, none whatsoever. Not with the Omanis, not with the Pakistanis, certainly not with the Iranians. Nothing going on. He's lying about that. And at the same time, he's not doing anything about this conflict in Ukraine except deepening it and making it more profound and more likely that Russia will determine we are an internal enemy as a result of that. And God knows what kind of repercussions that might have, especially if this incompetent president, Donald Trump, gets involved in that again. And he's not going to get involved to bring peace to it like he said he was originally. So we're merging these theaters in many respects and creating all kinds of little conflicts in the midst of them and urging, really, that they expand. And as you just hinted at, there is a possibility that in one or more of these theaters, we might see a nuclear weapon used. And that's, then we're off to the races. I mean, then we've got a really dangerous situation. I just listened to Glenn Dyson and the German general. You've probably heard him before too. Kujan. He was head of the German forces, and then he was very high in NATO too. And he gave an absolutely, to Glenn Dyson, he gave an absolutely, in my view, it jives with everything I knew when I was in the government, and I was close to it when I was in the government. He gave a brilliant recap of what happened from George H.W. Bush on to the future and the present, and how we screwed Russia left and right at every opportunity. And we did it increasingly using the situation in Ukraine, which Russia almost desperately tried to keep from happening, trying to protect the Russian population, trying not to go to war. And yet we kept egging it on, egging it on. Merkel was right when she said, essentially, all we did in 2014, all we did was just buy time to rearm Ukraine. He gave a tremendous presentation on that. He's right. He's absolutely right. So we have an empire right now, and it's led by a fool. It's led by an abject fool. But that empire has been at it since the first year of Bill Clinton's first term, trying to defeat Russia any way it possibly can, and discovering the proxy of Ukraine very early, and using it. And at the same time, trying to give Israel the excuse it needed to finish off the clean break strategy, that is to say, take out Iran, regime change in Iran. That's our whole strategy since Bill Clinton's first term. And it has failed abjectly. And we are now eating, confronting, dealing with that failure. And we haven't a clue what to do. And it's tragic, because we're going to put the world at war. We're going to put the world at war.
That, again, is retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson on the Dialogue Works program, and I'm going to come back to a few more minutes of him, since this kind of war topic in the region inevitably leads to this matter of Israel, and he has some comments on that. But just for a little bit of levity, I couldn't help make up a line when I listened to him talking about the drain of arms in Ukraine, right? So a few of you might remember The Music Man, the most famous musical in U.S. history, and I altered a line from that. Let's see, where is it? The drain in Ukraine is a pain for Commander Kane. All right? Put it to music if you like. Anyway, I thought that was really important, not joke, but I mean all the news that's coming out from various sources, including the mainstream and official and pro-capitalist ones, that we are indeed running up into shortages of weaponry. Any other comments from folks here?
They're talking a lot about the Patriot missiles and how Ukraine doesn't have any, but these take a long time to make. And right now the U.S. production is about 600 a year. And it's going to be a ramp up to 2,000 a year, but that won't start happening until 2030. And already Germany and Poland have given a lot of their Patriot missiles, which are anti-ballistic missiles, and so it's... It's one more conundrum that the U.S. has gotten themselves into.
Yeah, recent reports have Trump yelling and screaming in the room where he's being told that there are no good military options. And, you know, our omnipotence is proving to be mythical, and more people, even President Trump, may eventually wake up to that, although I wouldn't count on it. Here's a little more with the background and bigger picture of the war in West Asia from Mr. Wilkinson for just a few more minutes.
Bibi Netanyahu would discard the United States and take another super daddy in a heartbeat if he thought it was advantageous to do so. That's why I think fundamentally, many reasons for it, but fundamentally, that's why I think Israel is a strategic liability, not a strategic asset, because they are untrustworthy. Now, you could say almost any ally you would have in the world, from Germany to Japan, would at some point in time be judged untrustworthy within the relationship. But I would judge Israel untrustworthy 100% of the time, because they're always out for themselves. That's just my feeling. It's just the way I look at it since 1948. That's the way I think it's developed. They are a liability, not an asset. I don't know what they're thinking right now, because I don't know who's doing their thinking. I think increasingly it's not Netanyahu. And by that, I mean the thinking that generates plans, actions for the future. It's not Netanyahu. It is increasingly the group in Israel that supports Netanyahu while he's still in power, but wants him gone. And that's a group within Likud and a group within what I would call the parties that move in and out of Likud. And I don't know what's going to develop with Netanyahu's departure, other than worsening of the present circumstances. So as long as that's the future for this Jewish state, if it isn't destroyed by Iran, then it's going to become more and more a strategic liability for the empire. And sooner or later, that leadership in Israel that evolves from Netanyahu is going to have to find another sugar daddy or another arrangement. Will it be with China? Will it be with Russia? Will it be with will it be with Iran? Will it be in some other direction that we can't even envision right now? I don't know. Or will it just disappear? I subscribe to the theory that it's just going to disappear, unless it figures out a way to become a genuine democracy, accepts all citizens within that genuine democracy, has no vestige of apartheid left, and accepts the fact that eventually, unless it is incredibly productive itself, it's going to succumb to a majority of Arabs in its midst. I mean, that's just reality. Will that ever happen? I don't know. It could, but not with this leadership. This leadership probably has to be expunged. In fact, I was reading a piece the other day. The author said Zionism, in and of itself, certainly the kind of Zionism we're seeing espoused by Smotrich, Ben-Gvir, Netanyahu from time to time, and others, has to be destroyed.
What's happened with Ukraine, when the United States moved in there with the help of the neo-fascist organizations, they've taken over the whole media network. And Ukraine media network, Ukraine government media network is orchestrating a takeover of news that Americans get today that actually illustrates the wrong picture of what's happening in Ukraine and the NATO war with Russia. We see it having a disastrous effect on our electoral system, but also on the information we get. Look at Russiagate, you know. This was something that was orchestrated by the Clinton campaign and the Democratic Party to justify them losing the 2016 election. And that news network has continued to influence our electoral process, and Congress voting more and more billions of dollars for war. But the little partner of these organizations is the Cuban American National Foundation, CANF, which patterned itself after AIPAC, and they've been able to spend tens of millions of dollars influencing congressional people to support the blockade, even though it's against the wishes of the American people and the people in their districts. Just lately, the Democratic leadership has appointed Debbie Wasserman Schultz as the head of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. She is supported by AIPAC and CANF organization to continue the blockade of Cuba and the genocide in Gaza and the war in the Middle East.
Hey, let me add one positive thing. We only got about 1 minute left here, but agree with everything there. But there's also the recent victory by the anti-war candidate in Michigan, despite $60 million in outside funding going to the pro-war candidate, and half of that came from AIPAC. But nevertheless, without having that kind of deep pockets or backing, the anti-war candidate won in Michigan. So that was good news from yesterday.
Yeah, and that's because people got on their feet and went door to door and did the hard work of educating the American public.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been the Northern Sun Radio News. Don Olson, Dave Gudick, and Greg Clay were talking about Cuba and other things too. So thanks to all of you, and stay tuned for Global Beat.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
Summer 1901, the 30-odd college students, mostly girls, must have felt like they were on Mars when they were plunked down at the Minnesota Seaside Station. It was located nearly 2,000 miles northwest of Minnesota on the west coast of Vancouver, Canada. The year before, an enterprising botany professor, 31-year-old Josephine Tilden, had traveled there to study algae. This remote stretch of wind-buffeted coast was slick with algae-covered rocks, but also home to a dizzying array of flora and fauna. With her own money, she purchased 3 acres. Then, with help from her school, the University of Minnesota, she established the station as a summertime outdoor classroom. These students were the first class to arrive. Many were Midwest kids from farms and small towns, so nothing prepared them for low tide. Orange starfish, purple sea urchins, giant green anemones. The Minnesota Seaside Station introduced students to this tidal wonderland until 1907, when funding ran out.
MN90 is produced by AMPERS, Minnesota's community radio stations, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, online at mn90.org.